He is alumni professor, the Charles Barkley Endowed Professor and Chair of the Department of Agricultural Economics and Rural Sociology at Auburn University. Throughout his career, he has been conducting research on the economics of aquaculture and economic development. His teaching engagement cover courses on the economics of aquaculture, economic development, international trade. He has over 25 years working experience in the Caribbean and Africa. And he also worked long and short terms in 15 African countries. During his tenure at Auburn University, he represented Auburn University on an OSAID project in the Department of Farming System and Technology Transfer at the Institut Sénégalais de Recherche Agricole. He has also served as farming system economist on a similar project at the Institut de l'Économie Rurale in Bamako, Bali. He has received numerous awards for his scholarly research and teaching contribution. He is a member of the board of directors of Auburn University, Credit Union, overseas representatives of the Caribbean Agricultural Economic Society, and member of the American Agricultural Economics Association. Professor Jolie received his Bachelor of Science from Türkiye University, Master's in Agricultural Economics from Auburn University, and his PhD in Agricultural Economics from Louisiana State University. Please, Professor Jolie, the floor is yours.
First of all, I'll present you with a little outline on what we're going to talk about. And the objective is to review aquaculture and socioeconomic impacts in the new millennium, discuss institutional factors that facilitate aquaculture's positive socioeconomic impacts and or mitigate negative impacts. To do this, we rely heavily on literature review, and we have looked at the global situation so far, 2006-2008, the State of the World Aquaculture 2006 FAO, Aquaculture Changing the Face of the Waters, World Bank 2006, Perspective Analysis of Aquaculture Development, the Delphi Method FAO 2009. We looked at the Asia situation, Analysis of Aquacultural Development in Southeast Asia, 2009, Latin America situation, Aquaculture Development in Latin America Policy, Institutional and Economic Dimensions, FAO Fisheries Technical Paper, forthcoming. We go back again to the Bangkok Declaration and Strategy for Aquacultural Development Beyond 2000. And during the past three decades, aquaculture has become the fastest growing food producing sector and is an increasingly important contributor to national economic development, the global food supply and security. And you have heard much about that and about the potential of aquaculture to contribute to human development and social empowerment. You have also heard about the aquaculture sector should continue to be developed towards its full potential. And I think it was one of the speakers yesterday who talked about the vast potential that exists in Asia. And the speaker from representing Africa who talked about that there was still space for improvement over there. But to make a net contribution or to attain our goals in terms of attaining household food security, economic growth, trade, and improved living standard, we must establish and work within a framework. And hence, in order to examine how we can work and develop within a framework to attain this growth and development, we will look at the socioeconomic impacts of aquaculture, environmental responsibility, in that we look at habitat conservation, land and water, wild species energy. We'll also look at economic viability, contribution to economic growth, impacts of other industries, competition within aquaculture. As the other speakers have mentioned, talked about social acceptability in terms of, he talked about social licensing. That was a new term for me. We'll look at poverty alleviation, food security, human development, women empowerment, community cohesion, and social order. And also we'll look at institutional arrangements for environmentally responsible aquaculture, laws and regulations, environmental impact and assessment, environmental taxes, eco-labeling, self-regulation, codes of conduct, farmers associations, best or better management practices, on the economic viability and institutional arrangements. We'll look at trade barriers, tariffs, anti-dumping, market standards, public interventions in aquaculture production, property rights, seed production, feed production, capital, foreign direct investment, technology and know-how. Finally, we'll end up talking about institutional arrangements for socially acceptable aquaculture, public policies, NGOs, community-based aquaculture, co-management. As you have realized, there is a lot of there's a halo effect in the discussions from today and yesterday. So if I skip certain parts, do not think that I'm suffering from eyesight problem. I'm just trying to keep you awake. Under habitat conservation, basically what I will do, I'll present you with some pros and cons, and during our discussion, you'll add the meat and the gravy towards it. There has been stricter regulations in terms of clearing of mangroves for aquaculture banned in most Asian countries. There has been replanting and restoring of mangrove forests. There has been coastal planning and management and also best management practices. But there are still a number of issues in terms of how do we get rid of how we deal with the bottom ecosystem in terms of getting rid of sedimentation, especially in the areas of how do we handle the problems with the coral reefs, seagrass, how do we manage organic waste, especially when we do cage culture, some of our lakes and rivers are being polluted. Freshwater marshes and wetlands, improper agricultural practices. It is good to have economic returns, but we also have to minimize the effects of pollution. Land and water are essential in terms of aquaculture. I often ask my students whether they, at the end of the course, at the end of the program, they will develop a fish that grows out of water. If we could do that, we'd have no problems, but we need water, we need land. But aquaculture has its positive effects on the land in terms of rehabilitating sodic lands, providing nutrient-rich mud, reducing nutrient and heavy metal load in water by the use of certain species like oysters and so on. But on the other hand, we get to realize, in spite of the positiveness of aquaculture, there are negative impacts in terms of we have read about land salinization, eutrophication, and algal bloom, chemical pollution. And so therefore, there are some measures that must be taken to balance out the effects, such as planning and management, especially zoning. Whenever there are conflicts, zoning can be a way of mediation. Resource-conserving aquaculture practices, using land unsuitable for other purposes, and selecting the right type of land, of course, rotating the use of land and agriculture and fish farming. This is not always easy in a commercial aquaculture, though it is sometimes used for instance, in Louisiana and Alabama, Louisiana with rice and Alabama with cotton. But we also have to respect the fixity of assets in terms of aquaculture, integrated operations, and recirculating closed systems. Aquaculture has an effect on the wild species in that by producing our own fish, we reduce reliance on capture fisheries. There is also the drive to restock water bodies, and I was very surprised when I visited Namibia that one of the things they did was to restock certain dams and reservoirs. But so aquaculture helps in terms of improving certain species, but there are negative impacts in terms of environmental degradation and the use of wild seeds and the removal of exotic species. And, of course, when there are certain species that escape or introduced, like the red, the red oyster is in Vietnam. There are certain measures that can help in terms of regulation on seed collection. And artificial breeding can also be helpful, to minimize the effects on local stocks, or to introduce new genetic material that will enhance growth and productivity. Removal of SKPs as a precondition for farm licensing. Selecting sites with least impacts on wild stocks and promoting aquaculture practices that prevent SKPs. This is kind of difficult to manage, but it can be done. In terms of energy, we have not yet really settled as to the amount of energy required for aquacultural operations. But the impact of aquaculture energy has been recently been noted with the rise in the price of corn and feed. There have been serious impacts, especially on large-scale aquaculture that depend on corn and high-energy feeds recently. But also, there can be changes in terms of high electricity costs, especially when people use hydroelectric power, and there have been climatic changes that lowers the quantity of water available for aquaculture and human use. Is water circulation system more environmentally friendly? This is something we have to ask. And we have to look at the direct impacts of environment, indirect impacts through high energy consumption. How do we manage the environmental costs and at the same time maintain a high level of production? How do we manage the use of water, the use of energy, and at the same time continue to produce a level? But to study that, we need a life cycle approach in order that we study the whole system during a given period. Aquaculture contributes in many ways to agricultural development. There are three main ways. One is the linkage impacts. The second is the direct contribution. And there are other impacts that are often neglected or not quantified, but they are present. And one of it is we have the backward and forward linkages that's essential to move local industry, especially in rural areas, and this is essential for employment creation and for income generation. And then we have the direct contribution in terms of value added, labor income, especially in the processing industry, business profits, taxes, and revenues generated, especially when there is foreign exchange earnings obtained from overseas, and then employment at various levels, professional and even semi-professional level, and at the local, rural, unskilled labor levels. Other impacts include infrastructure, as cited in one of Dr. Ishamunda's document about Madagascar. You have the human capital aspect in terms of the number of people we train and we educate, and you have increasing productivity and foreign exchange component. And all this indirectly leads to development of the rural sector. As you can see here, the capture fisheries in the last decade has been declining, whereas aquaculture has been, from freshwater, has increased tremendously, especially in Asian countries. Shellfish has also had a noticeably increased over the last couple of decades. You could see it here and here. And aquatic plants have also increased, with minor changes in aquatic animals. I guess we're still scared about certain aquatic animals. Aquatic production versus capture fisheries, we see, for instance, in Asia, there has been remarkable increase in aquaculture over the years. But though the literature states that there has been a marked increase in Africa and Asia, they are still... We're talking from the base, and really there is still room for growth. In Europe also, there is room for growth. But so Asia is leading the path. World aquacultural production has contributed in terms of millions of tons, and in various sections, we see that there is already a significant impact. But as one of the speakers said yesterday, the impact is small. We're talking about 1% of agricultural GDP. And this is why we, in most cases, we can't get a voice in terms of policy formulation and governance, because we have not yet been really making much inroads. And the reason is we are still a young and growing industry, and we have not been, we are growing, but we are becoming essential in certain areas, but we're not making the desired impact we should be. But maybe it's a fault of measurement. But we know that, for instance, aquaculture complements capture fisheries because there's it helps in terms of increasing the demand for fisheries products, the oil and the ingredients for feed production. It reduces the cost of seafood processing and marketing when you have especially multi or polyvalent in processing industries. And it reduces the competitive pressure on capture fisheries. Well, however, there is competition within the aquaculture sector, and there can be positive impacts in terms of affordable seafood for consumers, technology diversification, species diversification, new markets, quality improvement, but hence there are negative impacts in terms of trade disputes. The Vietnam-United States trade dispute is, I just came from Hanoi and people have been telling me about it. I'm afraid to say anything because by the time I go back, I might be locked up. It's not so. You are flooding them. Of course, when the market is flooded with aquacultural products, and we saw that a few years ago with the shrimp production, sometimes producers can get out of aquaculture, and therefore government sometimes has to intervene. Aquaculture is also promoted as being pro-poor, and this is good. Poor people lack, however, capital and access to credit. They lack sometimes technical skills and management expertise, and they do not have the political and influence and bargaining power. However, and this can be eliminated if government comes in and gives tax exemptions and subsidies, provide infrastructure, provide quality seeds, training and extension, technology and innovation. But one of the things the government has to do is to also provide and assist with access to capital. Unless people get the capital required, they can't. Advantages of in terms of small-scale aquaculture, it is less resource demanding. And it keeps people in the rural areas to do what they should do. One of the disadvantages is that it is more flexible, lack of economy of scale, and difficult to coordinate. One of the speakers said yesterday, we can enhance economies of scale of small producers by asking them and making them work in groups or in cooperatives. But this also has its disadvantages. There's successful stories about policies in place limiting farm size in Thailand. Less successful stories, Africa policy biased against large-scale aquaculture. And then you have problems with low value versus high value. And this we can discuss further as to whether small-scale aquaculture should concentrate on low value or should concentrate on high value products. When you promote proper aquaculture or large commercial operations, there is also, in doing that, there are problems of suspicion against large commercial operations. They claim that large operations are profit-driven and exploit the poor to benefit the rich. If you go to Haiti and you look prosperous, they say, vous êtes un grand mangeur, you're a big eater. You are fat because you eat the small ones. So people tend to have this perception that you only got rich because you took from the poor. Merits of large operations, economies of scale, technology innovations benefit, always benefit the poor through employment and economic growth. Policy issues. Are regulations biased against large operations in Southeast Asia and Africa justified? We do not know. There are a number of papers addressing this, and you should look at it. But seafood as poor people's food, in this graph you see that the share of seafood in animal protein, and here you see total animal protein intake per GDP per capita. And you see the black and the red here, you see Asia and African countries form the most there. So a lot of the people in these areas depend on aquaculture to generate their animal protein source. Aquaculture contributes to food security in terms of employment, male, female, skilled and unskilled labor. And we talked about the disparities that exist already in terms of male-female handling of resources. We'll talk about that. And not only handling ownership and management, we talk about production in terms of domestic scales, exports, output stability, price stability. And aquaculture also contributes in terms of value added, business profits, labor incomes, tax revenues. And this all leads to food security in terms of availability, access, utilization, transitory security. This we showed already in terms of that, but let us continue. High trophic species farming and food security. One of this, it is good to talk about high trophic species farming, but also we use a lot of biomass, as talked about in Naylor's article, Naylor et al. In 2004. Economic perspective, provide employment and labor income if you produce high-value species. Positive impacts on food access, feed production, driving up the prices of food-grade pelagic species, more expensive fish, more income. But there must be some policy regulations in the use of food-grade species for feed production. Evidence on negative impacts of high trophic species farming on food security, not well documented. But what do we observe? We observe there is an imbalance in terms of exports and imports of feed. If we look at the utilization of feed, we see, and fish products, we see that most of it is for food, but fairly a large amount is for feed. And fish meal export to the world market is mainly to Peru, comes from Peru, and you have a large amount from Chile, and the other, and some from Denmark. On the other hand, the fish import, you get fish meal import goes mainly into Denmark, Norway, and China. So there is what you call concentration in the market and imbalance, which must be treated. In terms of fish trade balance, we see Asia as a negative balance of marine fish, whereas America's has a positive balance. And this does not necessarily mean that there's a large production in the Americas, but fish meal, I guess, is considered part of the Americas. Europe has a negative balance. And this is important and when we are planning our strategy for trade in the future. In Africa, there's a negative balance. And Oceania, there's a positive balance in terms of shellfish. We project the food fish demand, and if we're looking at our strategy for export in the coming years, we see that there will be a great need for marine fisheries, especially in Asia and America. And but in terms of shellfish, there will be a growing demand for it, but one of the things in calculating the demand, we were looking at population growth, and not really economic growth and other factors influencing demand. Aquaculture contributes to human health, and we all have looked at this about before, so we will not spend a lot of time on this in terms of the benefits of aquaculture. But also there are some negative impacts of aquaculture in terms of introduction of disease and to control invasive species. And you talk about professional hazards, and now we're talking about risk mitigation. In terms of knowledge, aquaculture contributes to knowledge in terms of training and extension, technology innovations, research, disease prevention, artificial breeding, and nutrition. On the socioeconomic side, we talk about women empowerment, constraints faced by these women, access to capital, resource management and utilization and ownership. Aquaculture helps in terms of community cohesion, but also there are problems in terms of conflicts and negation of human, negation of indigenous groups. And therefore, these things must be taken into consideration, plus environmental laws and regulations must be put into place in and form a comprehensive network to accommodate changes to be accepted in the future. In terms of environmental impact assessment, this has been spoken about, but one of the things we see about environmental impact, it's always done before, and it is done for large production units, and usually small production units are not included. Market forces can be used in terms of eco-labeling, and this has been already spoken about. But of course, eco-labeling is looked at as market distortion and sometimes favors small, the large producers and not the small-scale producers. In terms of tariffs, tariffs are disappearing, and there are few tariffs. Unfortunately, there's the anti-dumping tariff came about U.S. versus the Vietnamese government. But one of the things in establishing anti-dumping tariff, you have to certify that this individual is selling below world average prices or below cost, and it is difficult to establish this. Market standards, we have public versus private in terms of market standards, but most of this is established by international market standard as determined by WTO. But one of the things we have to establish is whether the market standards required for the developing countries, that has an effect on the developing countries in terms of improving the quality of fish that people consume locally. Property rights, licenses, permits, and so on. And one of the things we have to talk about, this must be in place for us to attain our goals. But in most developing countries, I'll stop here, one of the things we have to ensure is land tenure systems, land rights are in place, and the extraction of water. Because some of the individuals talk about water and extracting water from subsoil. If the laws are, especially in areas where you have mining, you do find there are problems with water rights and how to extract this water to be used in aquaculture. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Julie. Apologize for the time.
Okay. Good. We have to call on here Charles Magushi, Premachandra Wattage, Geoff Googly, Kai Wistrom, Mohan Tisdale, Ishamunda, and Riddler. Can come at the front to answer all the questions. I was told I'm supposed to present and the others.
Okay, the floor now is open for discussion, questions, comments, reflections from the floor, please. Yes, please, Professor Peter Edwards.
Peter Edwards from the Asian Institute of Technology. Professor Jolly, you mentioned that aquaculture competes with ecotourism. I mean, I think this in general is true, but there's also a linkage. I mean, in coastal areas, I've seen tour companies taking tourists look at fish cages in the coast in both Vietnam and Thailand, for example. Another example is sports fishing, either using aquaculture-raised sea to stock reservoirs which are used for fishing and rivers, or small ponds associated with restaurants which are actually, again, for tourism. They're very, very popular now in Southeast Asia and China. I've seen them. And another one is ornamental fish. I mean, is that aquaculture or not aquaculture? It depends on definition, but it's certainly an extremely important economically in many countries now, both in terms of production and consumers buying tropical fish. Thank you.
Would you like? Yes, please.
Thank you for your observation. Yes, aquaculture and other activities in ecotourism work together. In the United States, we use that a lot of what we call recreational fisheries. But we have to say that while it complements
tourism, there are also conflicts. I will not spend a lot of time on this.
Thank you. Please, gentlemen there.
Hi, Christian Rana, Stirling University. Two things. One is, as far as the what Peter said about taking tourists to fish farms is also common in Scotland, incidentally, where companies actually market that as a way of diversifying the income stream. So I think it is quite important. My main question was, how do you reconcile policy and policy issues with reinforcement? Because it is relatively easy to kind of draft a policy. How do you reconcile that aspect and the ability to reinforce it?
I think this question was raised in the previous, if I'm not wrong, a similar question was raised in the previous panel. There was a civil discussion on this. And if I may summarize what was said, is that you have to involve communities. You have to enforce participation of communities, not only in the formulation of policies, but also in the implementations. You have also to involve other stakeholders, NGOs, and so forth, and insist on the coordination of everyone's intervention in terms of what we called partnership, enforcing partnerships between the private and public sector. I think that's what was said. Obviously, everyone was on the view that enforcement is very difficult, and because not only it requires financial resources, but also human resources, which are not always readily available.
Okay, thank you. From the back there, Pedro Bueno, please.
Pedro Bueno, I'm not working now. There was a very fine comment on the floor yesterday by Amrit Bhatt on measuring the contributions of our culture a decade hence or a certain time span. And socioeconomic impact would probably be the best area where you can work on for aquaculture later on or sooner to make a good case for itself in with governments, with donors, and with those with the other stakeholders. Now, this morning I was in receipt of a series of Pew research projects on the socioeconomic impacts of fisheries. Perhaps this could be an area that the panel could try to work on and bring to the attention, or FAO to bring to the attention of the succeeding meeting, the COFI Subcommittee on Aquaculture, to try to discuss and put this on the board or on the agenda for a more specific and very easy to understand contribution of aquaculture, the socioeconomic impact contribution impacts of aquaculture on, say, poverty, livelihoods. I know, I am aware there are many small-scale studies. I was involved in one. And Nathaniel had done something in Turkey, that was started in Turkey, but a global measurement of these impacts, like what the Pew Research, is an OSS series. I can email it to you if you want, but I'm sure you know it more than I do now, that has precisely the answer to Amrit Bhatt's question yesterday. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the question, please.
To make a comment on what Pedro said, I think we all can only agree with him. And I would also like to underline the fact that we, in fact, already started this effort of trying to measure the contribution of aquaculture to food security, to poverty alleviation. One of the slides that Dr. Jolly showed there showed different linkages and so forth, direct contribution, indirect, then linkages backward, downward. We tried to This is actually the conceptual model we developed, and then we want to translate it into mathematics to try to come up with a measurable indicator of things. But when we sent it to people to try, although we had given some applications, they told us it was too heavy for them. So I think the next step we're undertaking is to to try to now to filter those formulas, like 30 pages of continuous formulas just gives a headache to people, to try to bring them down to earth. So we're trying to make that things user-friendly, and certainly many of you in the room will be consulted when we get to the stage of testing them on the ground. We're already collecting information in different countries, in Latin America and North America, to try to validate what we think will answer those questions. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Can I ask you first here to... Yes, please.
Hi, I'm from Bangladesh. I have a question to Dr. Neil Ridler. You mentioned in your slide that for the poor strategy, high-value fish is the option. But from our experience, I'm working at a project of it's called Catalyst. It's funded by ETFID. We are trying to promote aquaculture and high-value fish in there. But the thing is, high-value fish, you mentioned that these they will get to a higher profit, although there's a high amount of investment in it, but it gives high profit. So it offsets the capital investment, and ultimately they have a higher profitability. But the market price in our country, the high-value fish, are getting down because more farmers are containing the fish, and the high-value fish price is going down. Although they've got high value, they have high productivity, but their prices are going down. So with declining prices and more farmers coming into production of high-value fish, ultimately the profit margin might be lower again. And so then the capital investment would be a burden. So how do you see in a broader perspective? Now the farmers, there are less farmers. So it's like we say in the trade economics, it's a small country assumption. They cannot affect the market price now. But when there's a huge number of farmers cultivating the high-value fishes, the market value will be affected, and it might go down as it is going down in Bangladesh. So how do you see this as a pro-poor strategy?
Okay, thank you. The example I gave was from Indonesia, where, you know, it was reflecting the price of high-valued fish in Indonesia. Now, each country presumably will be different. But basically, high-valued fish often have high income elasticity. So as incomes rise, as we hope they do, per capita incomes, so the demand curve shifts out. For example, example I've done is looking at elasticity of demand for halibut, which is a high-value fish in North America. And the income elasticity is about 4. So as incomes rise, so the demand shifts out by about 4%. So I think, personally, in the long run, high-value fish have more potential for the future than low-value fish, because, as I say, we all hope that over time incomes will rise, and they're the preferred species for higher-income consumers.
Yes, madam, from the back.
The economists must remain busy in providing the type of information so that producers will be familiar in terms of with the net returns to whatever species you're producing, and provide some sensitivity analysis to show that when the price falls to a given level, that the farmers, what will happen to them, whether they'll continue producing or stop producing. But also, when something like that happens, that's why I said sometimes the government must intervene. But government can usually intervene if they have the information to help. In many cases, the U.S. government has come in and purchased fish that will remove it on the market for a given time so that prices will increase and producers will continue their levels of operation.
I agree with what Neil says, but of course, if it's a competitive market, then
microphone, please.
I agree with what Neil says, but of course, if it's a competitive market, then in the longer term, what will happen is the profit will fall in a competitive fall towards that level. So this is really, I think in the longer term, the demand for the higher priced fish will ish. But if enough producers come into it, then we're not going to have the profits maintained. So like salmon would be a higher priced fish, but what has happened is that it's now in a mature phase and the profits are low. So this is sort of what I'm thinking we would have to consider.
Sally Sarangpimon, Director of the Food School, Thailand and Canada. I asked this question yesterday, actually, but I think I asked it of the wrong panel or too soon. But I was wondering if any members of the panel would have... is there any model of governance in the world, anywhere in the world, that includes a social impact assessment prior to licensing of aquaculture operations in much the same way that there's environmental impact assessment? That's my first question. The second question is, if so, would a system like that, in your opinion, have the possibility of disenfranchising small-scale farms?
You've got the question.
Okay. I think many governments do, in fact, take into account social impact. And I'm sure that, for instance, the impact on indigenous people will sometimes be a major consideration in whether or not an aquaculture development should be developed or supported. So, for instance, in Australia, we would have Aboriginal people in the north, so there would be a consideration. And there also are pressure groups. So in Canada, that would be true. So I would think the social impact is very important. A lot of our cost-benefit analysis is not just based on... it should take into account not only sort of the return... not taking account of income distribution, but you should also then add something about the social impact in terms of income distribution or impact on different groups. And, of course, in a way, the sustainability criteria, which was mentioned for future generations, and I think this was mentioned by the speaker here, is also a social factor to be taken into account. So I think I would say that taking into account social things would favour the smaller producer rather than the bigger producer. That would be my feeling.
Okay. So now we have...
The social impact analysis and the in-depth of this would depend on the source of funding. Most banks, including donor agencies and groups, the World Bank, would require a social impact, and this would have to be very thorough in terms of looking at ethnicity, gender, and employment and the various factors.
Yes, you would like to add?
I would like to add an example. It's a study done in the Philippines. The researchers' conjecture was that this kind of high-value farming, you know, by those rich people tend to anti-poor, but eventually the results show that they are poor because they produce a lot of employment. I forgot the exact citations, but it's in the paper. I just want to mention there's a study like that.
We have three questions here. Yes, please. You first.
Yeah. I was thinking in, well, first of all, congratulations for the presentation. I was thinking in Pedro's question on And I agree with what he's saying, and actually that was raised yesterday by a gentleman, I don't remember who he was, about really measuring how are we gonna measure if we achieve the next decade goals for agricultural development, and in terms of socioeconomics and sustainable development of aquaculture. I think it's not only these studies that Professor Pashmunde is referring that he has conducted in terms of setting the baseline of how economic, socioeconomics is in several countries in the world, but it's probably important that several indicators for sustainable development are selected to work with. And in that sense, we have already important work developed by, for example, the consensus, the European Consensus Group, who already selected for Europe several indicators of sustainable development. I'm not saying they are the only ones, but probably that would be important for in terms of socioeconomics and sustainable development, to select or recommend what kind of indicators could be continuously evaluated in the next decade.
Now it's 12:30. So we will have the two last questions. Can I please invite the gentleman in red and Professor Edwards?
Christian Rana Sterling. A couple of observations. One, I think we should be careful about when we say things like high and low value species. I'll give you an example, just to make a very important point, is that in the UK, salmon is cheaper than tilapia. It's about
40% cheaper than tilapia. So which is higher value for me? So that's the first question I think we need to think about as we talk about high and low value. And I think there's more to it than just
that in terms of our modelling.
The second question is, I'm just doing some review at the moment for FAO, about 10 case studies, and I thought I'd just share something with you regarding the economics. Is that we did a cost-to-benefit ratio analysis on a whole range of production systems in terms of inputs. But what was fairly clear is that the cost-to-benefit ratio
was more or less the same in what we regard as low-input systems
and high-input systems. So really the question, therefore, is from a policy point of view, is if you want to move people out of poverty,
absolute income is the issue. We have to figure out a way of how they can get access to credit to increase the input, because that is what is actually limiting the ability of these systems to move out of the poverty and generate more income. So really the issue is credit
and operating capital.
Thank you. Yes, Professor Peter Works. And then the last question would be
Yeah, I'm following up on this high value, your low value fish business. I mean,
the prices don't just go down, they go up. And tilapia is a very good example. In Thailand, for example, 30 years ago, it was a very low value fish, and people in urban areas didn't like to eat it, certainly better off people.
But now the marine fish became very expensive, and the price of tilapia, even though there's a massive increase in production of tilapia, there's a much greater demand, and the price has actually gone up as well. So it's very complicated. I think low value, high value is an oversimplification.
Thank you. Yes.
Just one comment on the sustainability.
Only very recently, I mentioned this in the other panel too, that Professor John Moore, who was the author of Club of Rome report, Limits to Growth, which initially raised the issues on sustainability in the long term. People with gray hair will remember this book, which came out in 1973. He mentioned only about 3 weeks ago, sustainability is a matter of attitude more than anything else. It would be very, very hard to pinpoint measurements or indices of measurements, because it's so variable from place to place, culture to culture.
That and so forth.
to that. It's an attitude of sustainability. What Canada may consider as sustainable, Sri Lanka may not consider as sustainable. The only underlying thing is it is an optimal or rational use of primary resources so that the next generations have something to be left with. With Amrit Bhatt's point came up, I want to stress the fact that in my opening address, I very clearly mentioned that we need to have indices for measuring the performance of aquaculture growth in the next 10 years. And I also insisted, or rather mentioned in my opening speech, that 10 years is perhaps too long a period of time, and that we should really bring it to 5 years because of the dynamism of the sector and the very rapid growth of all the sectors and the problems that arise globally and due to globalization and so forth. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. It's now lunchtime, so we will close here. A big hand to our panel members. And we will resume in this room at 2 o'clock. Please enjoy your lunch.